My guest is Victoria Main. Victoria Main is a media strategist with the consulting firm in Brussels, SEC Newgate EU. She's a former journalist and is widely recognised in Brussels as an expert on the Brussels EU media scene. Welcome to the podcast, Victoria.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for the fine introduction. I'm honoured to be here.
Right, the honour's mine as well. Well, as I said in the intro, you know a lot about the Brussels media scene, and normally that may not be a subject of a podcast, but as you know, as well as anybody else, if not better than anybody else, there's been so many changes quite recently, but also going back. And obviously, this podcast, I suspect, will focus on the English language Brussels media scene and these are specialist outlets who focus on the EU almost to the exclusion of everything else, as opposed to more what we used to call mainstream media. But when do you think these changes first started to happen? People say there's a kind of Brussels before or after Politico, which has just celebrated its 10th anniversary. By saying that, are we maybe paying too much attention to Politico as a major disruptor on the Brussels media scene?
Interesting question. Just to go back a little bit, to say that the Brussels media scene was a bit of a yawn before Politico arrived is a tad unfair, in that journalists went about their business, which was decrypting the often complex EU dossier, making it relevant and understandable for their readers. So they were doing what they were paid for. But yes, 10 years ago, along came Politico with its stated aim of wanting to sex up Brussels. And a lot of people were sceptical, but they were helped by an irrepressible Antipodean called Ryan Heath,
oh, right,
who penned the original Brussels playbook and Brussels influence. So we'd all wake up in the morning and reach for Ryan to see what mischief he'd caused overnight. So he was a bit of a phenomenon. And along the way, there have been various minor, I call them celebrities, Politico celebrities, who've carried the torch because Ryan unfortunately had to go to Washington. So 10 years on, Politico is going through a bit of a rough patch. It's been rudderless for the last 6 or 7 months, lacking editorial direction. They haven't had somebody running the newsroom, and also absolutely bleeding talent, losing journalists left, right and centre. But, Paul, relief may be at hand for Politico in that they have announced finally, 6 or 7 months on, a new executive editor for Brussels in Carrie Budhoff-Brown, who's actually returning from the US in September to try and right the ship. So whether we're paying too much attention to Politico or not, I'm not sure, but it's very much a matter of love it or loathe it. It's always very difficult to ignore.
Right. Okay. Well, it's funny you should talk about the personalities there, because I promise listeners, this is not all going to be about Politico over the next 25 minutes. Having said that, is there a secret sauce about what the distinctiveness of Politico? As you know, it has a big fan base in Brussels. People like the fact that it covers all sorts of topics and personalities that other outlets didn't always do, but then also has its critics, as you know. I say that because I remember I had a conversation with Lionel Barber when he was editor of the FT, and I was saying to him, you know, why don't you realise, all you people, especially the FT, that you should try and put a human face on Brussels? When it's no good talking about the EU or the Commission, put down the name of a commissioner. At the beginning, they won't know who that commissioner is, but after a time, the readers will get to know by sheer repetition. Is there a kind of secret sauce, or especially at Politico's launch, which explains its quite impressive success these past 10 years?
Well, size has mattered with Politico, and that they are the biggest shop in town, so they're all over Brussels. Mm. They go into sometimes questionable personal details of politicians. I remember when Ryan covered the fact that Jean-Claude Juncker had, I can't remember what it was, but he had some ailment, right, and everybody thought this was beyond the pale. So it is a little bit naughty. It has been a bit naughty. So I think maybe they've taken journalism, Russell's journalism, into the realm of the personal to a certain extent.
Right. Well, since the EU was created, there have been this long tradition of very venerable, some would say almost too venerable, EU specialist newsletters, right, which have basically reported on the events as they occurred. They were often disparagingly described as just reproducing press releases back in the days. Do you think that there's still a role for these more traditional newsletters, which are obviously very pro-European? They believe very much in what's called the European project, and some readers prefer that rather more traditional, almost safe way of reporting EU affairs as opposed to the slightly more racy editorial style that Politico has?
I think there's still a place for those, but I think the market has moved on to a certain extent, so that we're seeing, for example, Euractiv, new ownership, it's powering up in terms of staff. They've taken a few from Politico. They are also trying to shake things up. One of them, the editor-in-chief, if his Chattering Classes newsletter is to, I won't say if it's to be believed, but if we can take a hint from it, it's absolutely obsessed by Politico and is practically every issue.
And the guy, of course, is an ex-Politico staffer, right?
Exactly. So he seems to have a real gripe against Politico. What that's about, I have no idea, but Euractiv is definitely to be watched. Another rather sedate, previously sedate outlet, Emelex, which is horrendously expensive for us. We don't subscribe
to it.
It is a regulatory risk newsletter. Celebrated its 20th birthday the other day. It has taken on personality under the helm of a Canadian journalist, Kate Bolingaro. So we see the individual journalists trumpeting on social media their scoops, their moderating successes. So that's quite a departure from previous practice. And then we have the French media outlet Context,
right,
is venturing into the English language under Jack Schickler, who was until recently was at Euronews. So it's a real, I think we've never seen anything like it in terms of ructions.
But do you think that these new players, or these new kind of restyle players who've been around a while but want to under new ownership, for example, as you mentioned, Euractiv, are introducing element of competition amongst each other in a way that we didn't used to have that in this sleepy little town called Brussels. The idea of competition between news outlets seems to be a relatively new phenomenon. Is that correct, or I was just asleep at the wheel?
No, you weren't asleep at the wheel, rest assured. No, they really, really are extremely competitive. I mean, the FT kind of reigns supreme in terms of prestige.
Right.
The Economist, they don't need to, I don't think so far, indulge in this competitive behaviour. But you see Politico with Euractiv yapping at its heels, really is having to up its game, make an effort with, as I mentioned, the new editor coming in. She will be fending it off against inroads from a former colleague, Matthew Karnitschnig,
right,
and also another former colleague in Suzanne Lynch, who is one of the many people who've left Politico to be bureau chief at Bloomberg. So she's been hired to raise the profile of Bloomberg. You may think, goodness, does Bloomberg even need its profile raised? But in Brussels, we're seeing personality come through in terms of these media outlets.
It's interesting about Bloomberg, as you say, they're a major media outlet. They've been in Brussels for quite some time, and they've been reporting on EU affairs for quite some time. But you wouldn't really know, unless you're a real specialist, who Suzanne Lynch's predecessor was, because he had quite a low profile, to say the least.
He did. Whereas Suzanne is, you know, a bubbly Irish woman. She will be, I'm sure, on radio, on TV, not just on Bloomberg outlets, but really publicising what Bloomberg's about. And we're also seeing, for example, at another outlet, which actually did exist in Brussels, but you wouldn't have known it. It was so low profile and so specialist in the Capital Forum. But in January, Javier Espinosa, formerly of the FT, was made European Executive Editor. Everybody knows Javier.
And what is the Capital Forum? What's
Capital
its niche?
Capital Forum is in, it's based in Washington. It's a little bit like MLX. It covers competition matters. But it almost doesn't matter in that Javier is the face of the Capital Forum in Brussels. He's doing newsletters, scoops, podcasts. He's right. All over it. His marketing people must love him.
Right. And you mentioned briefly earlier Euronews, a roundoff. Okay, ostensibly it is a broadcast organisation and increasingly digital TV. But it also does a lot of print stuff as well, right, with on its website. It is a strange animal that has new ownership, which is slightly controversial, as we all know. But also it is keen to establish itself here in Brussels. Just to remind listeners, it's moved its headquarters after 30 years in Lyon to Brussels about 2 years ago. This is by way of context, as you know this, Victoria. But they're also trying to move more into the written word space, right? The online written word space.
They have, and it launched its kind of print, if you have it, service maybe a bit more than a year ago with a bit of fanfare, but it's been a bit under the radar lately. Maybe they're not wanting to indulge in this politico-eruptive tit-for-tat. There is another outlet as well, actually, just when we thought we'd covered them all, and it's the Brussels Times.
Oh, of course.
Which was covering just Brussels news, but it has a readership of not just Anglo, but kind of Brussels bubble insiders, and they're venturing much more often into European news with former BBC reporter Philip Hurd, or former BBC correspondent Philip Hurd, at the helm. So they're spreading their wings as well.
And there were rumours, maybe premature rumours, that maybe other US outlets like Axios or even Semaphore might be thinking about some kind of move into Europe, as they say, or into Brussels. Do you have any intelligence on that?
I don't know about Axios, but Semaphore was rumoured to be sniffing around a few Brussels correspondents to see whether or not they would take on the Herculean task of doing a type of Brussels playbook solely, single-handedly. They didn't have any success, but when I made contact with them, said they're probably going to later in the year, so I must check up on them.
Right. We tend to forget, as just people like, just consumers of news, if you like, that news outlets, of course, are organisations, but they are businesses, and they need to survive financially, commercially, otherwise there's no future for them. Without going into too much details, we haven't got time on the podcast. In terms of the business model, this competition we've been talking about throughout the chat so far between different players and some of the new players or the reinvigorated older players, does that translate also into the business model? They're all vying for the same revenue pot, right, of subscriptions and all the rest of it. How do you think that's working? Is there enough to go around, or will some of these outlets suffer because there's only so many subscriptions that customers are prepared to pay for or able to pay for?
I think you make a very good point, Paul. And at the beginning, 10 years ago, Politico was hoovering up the newsletters to subscribe to. They're very expensive. If you get quite a few, it does mount up. So it's interesting in that many people are now asking me, what about Euractiv? Because they're charging for quite a few of their newsletters. I don't know how that's going, but people are certainly showing interest. Also on the event front, I see more and more Euractiv events. Euronews is in the event space as well. I'd still say that Politico is reigning supreme, but it's again got Euractiv yapping at its heels and probably eating into it.
Right.
But with the appointment of this new old repurposed Carrie Budhoff Brown, that may stem that movement. I think people will give Politico until September when she comes.
Mm. Do you think there's therefore more pressure on the journalists to not just to produce more stuff to justify people paying these subscriptions, but also to be on the constant lookout for so-called scoops? Are there enough scoops in Brussels to keep everybody happy?
Probably not, quite honestly. And you do get them. You do get different outlets quibbling over who got a scoop first, whose scoop is better. When you mentioned the journalists, this is very interesting in that suddenly with all these new or repurposed outlets, they have more choice of jobs.
Of course,
so
yeah.
Even if they don't...
The marketplace for jobs, right.
The marketplace for jobs is amazing. And so they can look around. Sometimes they consider jumping. Then they get cold feet.
Right.
Then they negotiate a pay rise, a promotion. Politico did lose quite a few. Two to the FT, and several to Euractiv. One to Dow Jones, not that I'm counting, but they have lost quite a few.
Right. Maybe we should move on. I'm guilty of making this a tiny bit incestuous, this conversation about the media world. It's interesting, we kind of turned the tables, if you like, on the media there. We're talking about them rather than they talking about us. So let's move on briefly in the time we have left, Victoria, to two things. One is how the EU institutions deal with this changing media scene, and your take on to what extent the institutions, the Commission, the Parliament, the Member State representations, embassies, etc., are raising their game, improving their game. And then secondly, I see how much time we have left, about how the world outside, the private sector, companies, associations, NGOs, etc., also deal with the media. So let's start with the EU in very broad terms. Do you see a significant improvement? Because in the old days, right, people would say, well, Brussels is boring, but the EU makes Brussels even more boring. Have the institutional communications specialists, professionals, improved their game?
They try. They do try. Whether they succeed or not is questionable. It is amazing, though, that the Commission practically every weekday has a midday briefing. It's an admirable effort. It's an admirable exercise.
And that's a physical gathering of journalists in the press room, right?
Yes, and journalists in theory can ask any question they like. The answers they get, that's another story.
Right.
So you often hear from journalists that the midday briefing is a waste of time in terms of content, but they do go down there once in a while to speak to people behind the scenes, around the edges, the margins of the briefing. Also, there are technical briefings, which are quite useful. The problem with them, though, is that they're technical, and often a story in Brussels comes to life by dint of the politics.
Right.
And the politics are always left out of what the Commission's talking about. Also, at the Council, I gather the actual press service is constrained by what they're allowed to say. But journalists who get stories out of the council, it's like anywhere, they forge relationships with helpful officials who will decrypt what's going on and bring it to life. Also at the Parliament, the press service, again, is not very useful at all. So you have to kind of get to know one of the key spokespeople. There's an excellent one there.
But then you find then this European Commission, for example, individual commissioners or the European Parliament, individual MEPs, forget about the kind of the broad infrastructure of communication, but these individuals, the commissioners, MEPs, by way of example, are not all of them, but some of them are quite media savvy. They're on social media accounts. They know they do stuff, put stuff on Instagram, on TikTok. They developing their own way of reaching the outside world, or is it still very much institutionalized?
I think it's a bit different from that, in that I think it's very tightly controlled by Ursula von der Leyen.
Right.
So they are communicating a lot on various social media platforms, but it's a rare commissioner who will actually say something that's interesting or off script. So, you know, you get Sefcovic speaking about trade, but it's within narrowly defined and agreed lines. So I think they're practically all they're on the leash. So I don't think there's much fun to be had.
Okay. Well, let's finish off then by talking about, let's call it the outside world. As we all know, Brussels is a town of lobbyists, of lobbying and all sorts of organisations that are doing that, whether it's corporations, obviously, trade associations, non-governmental organisations, other countries, what we call third countries, charities, trade unions, you name it, everybody seems to be in the lobbying game. And of course, lobbying in the first instance is about trying to affect the process by direct contact with policymakers, commission officials, commissioners, MEPs, national civil servants, etc., etc., etc. But when it comes to using the media as a way to help shape or advance a particular argument, how organized and how professional are all these different outside groups in your professional opinion?
They vary. They really do vary from organizations that are just lost in their own acronyms. Mm. And we really struggle to help them communicate to busy journalists who haven't got the time to look up and see what a particular acronym stands for, to those which are much more media savvy and don't really need much help in terms of communicating to the media. A key part of communicating to the media is having relationships.
Right.
It really is having relationships. And it pays to actually like journalists or even just pretend to like journalists. Journalists are people too.
Right.
And their agenda may not be your agenda, so you have to meet them halfway.
You say that for a reason, I presume. I'm not asking you to be specific, but you come across examples of these different lobby individuals, organizations, not really knowing how to deal with journalists and not really appreciating them for what they are, the journalists themselves are doing.
Yes, sometimes people think that journalists are out to get them.
Okay, yes.
And they're really not out to get them. And particularly in a corporate or a trade association, just obviously you have to have your wits about you.
Yeah.
It's not like chatting to you, Paul. you have to have your wits about you. But the bottom line is they want a story. You've got to recognise that. You may be building a relationship, but the end game has to be a story. And you've got to kind of be aware of that. But that doesn't mean the journalist is evil.
Okay. Well, to finish off, it strikes me, and things are slowly getting better, I suppose, that one thing which unites, brings all these different groups together, journalists themselves, the institutions, the outside world, the private sector, lobbying institutions, is, as you hinted at just now when referencing acronyms and this alphabet soup of acronyms that seem to infect Brussels, is the need to, before you even start doing your job, you need to explain, or at least understand, obviously, the processes and the different way decisions are taken and policy is formulated, but then also to convey that, to explain that to your readers or to your bosses or to your members or whatever it is. So do you think that's something that is still a major issue? Before you can actually write something, you first of all have to, A, obviously, understand it, but then B, find ways to explain what could be quite, not just complicated, but quite arcane matters.
Yeah, absolutely. You do. So you have to educate the internal kind of company or trade association, get them to realise what the journalist may or may not see as a story.
Right.
And then to link it to a particular moment in time, the so-called milestone on the regulatory calendar.
Right.
And latch on to that. Sometimes you may just need a preparatory piece of relationship building to find out what the journalist is actually interested in.
Right. Well, we've covered an awful lot of ground in such a short period of time, but we have to leave it there. Victoria Main, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure.